in props, and there's a lot of older people that have been in props for years, and you can learn so much from them. It's starting from just a sort of dream and then making it a reality, and being able to do something that you love every day.
Someone else providing a step up the career ladder is Paul Taggart, who's head of the plastering department. Let's join Paul on one of our stages as his team puts together a rather special set. It's going to get a little loud in here.
I could not wish to pick a better bunch of guys to have working, you know, with alongside me. Not for me, alongside me. They're a great bunch of guys, and they just go that extra mile, which I really do appreciate. You know, they're all good guys. They've all done their apprenticeships, you know, some in the film industry, which we're trying to bring along apprenticeships now. We've got, over this film, I think we've had about 30-something apprentices in the different trades, you know, not just in the plastering department, but we're trying to bring along as many as we can because they are the future. And without them, there will be no film industry. And we want to just encourage those. And the rest of the guys have done apprenticeships on an outside company, building companies, some in the film industry, but vast majorities on sort of building companies, on commercial stuff on the outside of the film studios. I actually got into the film industry through an advert in the newspaper back in 1980. The film industry was so busy, I was just flicking through the paper, saw this advert. I kind of got a bit fed up where I was working, and I thought, oh, I'll have a try of that. I knew a couple of guys that worked at the studios, phoned up, had an interview, and I've been working in the industry ever since. So that's how I first started. I still get a little bit of a buzz when I walk into the Harry Potter Museum, even though I worked on dismantling it all from the original films and refitting it all back together, and I still get fascinated by it. It's just, I love it. I just really do love going through there, and it just gives me a little kick all the time to think, oh, I'm so proud to have been part of that. You know, it's really, really something to be proud of.
And last but not least is George Bootman. George works as a visual effects assistant coordinator, but that wasn't always his job.
I used to work at, well, this isn't quite exactly how I got into it, but I used to work at the Harry Potter, the Warner Brothers studio tour just next door. And I worked there from the day it opened, the grand opening day, and got to know a lot of the people that worked on Harry Potter films whilst I was there, and loved it. I loved working there so much. I was always ridiculously keen about knowing every single thing about Harry Potter. I'm a massive Harry Potter fan in myself, as a lot of people know that work on the film. And therefore, I was very keen to know everything I could. I was always asked the props guys that I met there about how they built everything and the behind the scenes facts about it, the graphics guys. And as soon as Fantastic Beasts was announced, I think in 2013, I just said, oh, I need to work on that. I'd love to do that. I didn't know where I could fit in. I was really unsure about that. And I just basically emailed so many different people, as many people as I could, over about 5 or 6 months, where I was just like, please, here's a new CV, I can do this now, here's an updated CV, please. And I think I did a week's work experience in the art department, which was really cool. But separately, I think my production manager found my CV along with other copies. I think they were receiving multiple copies of my CV in there, and they thought I had an interesting name, and I don't know, they just wanted to interview me. The art department said I was okay, and yeah, the rest was kind of history in that sense. Luckily, they asked me to be a VFX runner on the first Fantastic Beasts film, and they liked me. So yeah, and I'd never stopped enjoying it. That's really nice. It's funny, whilst I worked at the studio tour, I was in, well, they auditioned loads of us to be in the Harry Potter, the advert for the studio tour. And I got a speaking part. And I say a speaking part, yes, they dubbed everyone's voices with children's voices. So I'm in that dressed as Harry Potter. And it's funny because at the time I sort of thought, this is as close as I'll ever come to working on a Harry Potter film set. But a year and a half later, I got the job on Beasts, and, you know, now we're running around on Hogwarts and we're filming in Hogwarts, so I get to work in the full 360 sets, and that's amazing. They showed it in cinemas in the end. It was the biggest, like, weird circle for me ever, because they ended up showing the advert I was in for the studio tour before the showings of Fantastic Beasts in the cinema, like, all across the UK. And so it was the weirdest thing having, like, I didn't realise they were going to do it, and I went into the cinema. My nan burst into tears when she saw it. I was in the advert there, watched the film I'd worked on, the very first film I'd worked on, and then I was in the credits at the end, so it's almost like I bookended the film in that sense. But yeah, so that was really cool.
Joining the new crew members is another new cast member, Brontis Jodorowsky. Although his character has been around for a very, 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 very long time. And his name will be familiar, or dare I say, familiar, to Potter fans. In the first film, we learned that Nicholas Flamel was a medieval alchemist who discovered the Philosopher's Stone and thereby achieved immortality. But Nicolas Flamel was also a real person who lived in France in the 14th century.
Well, it's like a big challenge too, you know, because when you have to create a character that already exists, there's books about him, there's stories about him, so people are kind of expecting something. And also the Harry Potter or J.K. Rowling's fans, they're like expecting something, so that's big pressure. So you just have to trust the script in that case and the situations that you're supposed to play.
But there's another element to Nicolas Flamel that makes him even trickier to play, his age.
So I got a call from an agent, a casting agent. So she says, I would like you to come. I can't tell you what it is for. Sure. So I get a scene with a character named Normand Foucault. Okay. And this was a scene that's not in the script, in fact. It just was a casting scene. But I can read in the scene that he is 600 years old.
That's pretty old, folks. But it's also a challenge. And there's nothing us actors like more than a challenge. Luckily, makeup and prosthetics are on hand to help out.
Well, when you have this transformation, right, that I have with the prosthetics and all this, and the change of age, and practically the change of face, you have 3 hours and a half or 4 hours of makeup. So it's a long process when little by little, it's not like if you're putting something on you, it's like you're erasing yourself and allow the character to come. It would be very pretentious to say that I arrived prepared knowing the character, because you discover the character along with the situations. I read about alchemy, I read about him, I made my research, which is some sort of basis, but you're not supposed to perform your studies, right? You have to live a situation in the moment, and I did exactly the same things. This moment, these 4 hours of preps gives you time to completely get into someone else. Like this, it's even stronger because you really change your face. You have the hair, the wig, everything. So it's really, the hands are completely different, you know, the age. So it's a wonderful prosthetics work. And then it's trying to imagine, but it's impossible to know, what is it to be 600 years old? What state of mind you have, especially if you are someone who got the spiritual degree of making the Philosophical Stone.
As well as an intense aging session, there are other things for an actor to keep in mind when playing 600-year-old men.
Including their voice.
Brontis Jodorowsky.
It comes really from an intuition. I do have some uncles and aunts that are aged, past the 90 years old. So I do hear that there's a transformation of the voice. It gets a bit higher and vibrates in a specific way, but I don't try to preconceive it too much. It came on the set, I tried some things, and I was like waiting for David to tell me, no, I don't think that's very appropriate, but he didn't. So, you know, on the artistic level. So it came like that. Well, he's still dressed like in his old days, right? I think the movie's around the end of the 20s, and he's dressed still with an ancient robe and middle-aged little pointy shoes. So it's this kind of guy, and he's been there for at least 200 years, not going out of his house, and going on with his research, because I think the spiritual research is a never-ending thing, especially if you're 600 years old, you know. You got to do something with your time.
Speaking of which, it's probably a good time to head back to class. And the lesson with Hogwarts' Defense Against the Dark Arts professor, Albus Dumbledore. Dumbledore is, of course, played by Jude Law, for whom teaching runs in the family.
Well, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. The children in that scene were so thrilled to be there, and David constructed the whole scene and the whole shooting of that scene, so it really felt like a class. So there they were, wide-eyed, thrilled to be, you know, in this familiar surrounding, the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom. And my parents are both teachers, and so I really enjoyed being their teacher for the day. And, you know, with all the familiarities of it being a Boggart lesson, and it's funny because it was a few months ago now, so it's interesting for me to already look back on it with fondness. But it was slightly odd out-of-body experience, because I've watched with everyone else those classes and those schoolrooms, and suddenly to be in it and be in that position was, as it sometimes is in acting, it's somewhat out of body. You're in there doing it, but then you look back as yourself and realise how special it was. When you're in a classroom that is, for all intents and purposes, an entire classroom with the detail and the props, and even when you look out of a window, the backdrop of what you know, the painted backdrop of what's to be seen through a window is there. It makes that little leap of the imagination for an actor very easy.
And it was in that classroom that Dumbledore's friendship with Newt began, as Jude Law explains.
So obviously they have that relationship, which is one of, I think, great trust. I think it's fair to say that Dumbledore recognised the brilliance in Newt and the really good heart and the morally unbendable core of Newt as a man.
There's no way that Newt's everyone's cup of tea.
Oh, hey, Eddie's back.
And certainly probably wasn't many of the staff at Hogwarts' cup of tea, but he has something unique to him and special to him that Dumbledore saw. I think we all can kind of relate to that, those teachers that you got on particularly well with. For me, it was always in life those teachers that were true to themselves, that you sort of wanted their approval. But I think what's interesting in this film is one of the reasons that Dumbledore loves Newt is because he is so true to himself. But then there's that weird thing when you leave school and suddenly these teachers are in your life and you don't know whether to call them sir or professor, or then you start calling them by their first name, and that feels all kinds of odd.
And once Newt left school, the dynamics of that relationship changed.
What happens throughout the film is Newt realizes he's not only being manipulated by the ministry, but he's also being manipulated by Dumbledore. And it's as he investigates that and understands that, and there's a transparency that he demands, because Newt is too wily to be exploited.
As if that would stop Dumbledore. You, Dumbledore, you.
Albus is one of those people that operates three steps ahead of everyone else, and so you could accuse him of not manipulating, but leading people into doing things that they don't particularly want to do, but that they can't resist because of their own emotional involvement, of their own moral motivation. He has an ability just to sort of lead them into doing that, because he also knows it's the right thing to be doing and he can't do it himself.
That's where there becomes a level playing ground, and Dumbledore can only achieve what he needs through, I suppose, through the skill set that Newt has and the friendship that they have.
He does do the same thing with Harry. And what's interesting is it's also, you know, what you don't know can't harm you. He lets people know just enough and not feel the burden of seeing everything too soon.
But Dumbledore has a burden of his own.
There is someone who has been told since being an infant that he was special and great and has the capability of being very powerful. And then at just the wrong time, formative years, he goes through a crushing personal drama. So he's someone who has greatness and memories of peace and domestic bliss as a child, who is then dealing with really deep, harrowing wounds and scars from formative years. His experience with Gellert Grindelwald as a young man, I think, wounded him equally.
Ah, yes. Gellert Grindelwald.
And if you know your Potter lore, you'll remember that Dumbledore and Grindelwald met in their late teens, They got along pretty well, until the whole thing ended in tragedy.
I saw it very much in preparation as the best of times, the worst of times. You know, he was probably a very misunderstood, slightly isolated teenager who had been through and suffered a certain amount of domestic complexity, and suddenly here's this guy who's just as smart and just as ambitious and anarchic as he is, and they have a golden summer together. That obviously manifested itself in a way that maybe Albus didn't see as being a threat or as being something that was leaning towards extremist. And it also ultimately ended up in the destruction of his family, because the two of them were forced to confront each other. That scar, and the fact that it, you know, this tragedy in the family, this threat that he feels he had contributed to, came from a place of opening up and being and sharing an intimacy. And I think that's really what's packed his heart almost with ice in a way and forced him into a monastic almost state of permanent neutrality in a way with regards to, you know, letting anyone into his heart, his emotions. No, not his emotions, his heart. You know, I think he sees himself as a monster because of that, because of how he was fooled, how love ultimately led him astray. And it's why I think he is so taken with Newt, because Newt loves monsters. Newt gives monsters affection and he understands them. And I think he therefore sees and hopes that Newt will understand him.
But Dumbledore isn't the only one at Hogwarts that is drawn to Newt's accepting nature. Back to you, Eddie.
There's a moment in this film where you see young Newt in Hogwarts, and he's got his own sort of tiny cupboard menagerie there already, and Leta comes barging in accidentally, and Newt is playing with this, or trying to heal this damaged raven chick, and Leta goes, "Why do you care about that?" And he goes, "Oh, because it's hurt." And it's a completely true response, and Newt has such empathy to anyone that is hurt. It's almost like he's a sort of magnet for damaged people and damaged creatures, and it's what he's best at, is helping people.
I love their relationship.
Hey, Zoe's back.
Because it's their oddness that brings them together. You know, I think on paper their friendship might not make so much sense, but, you know, Newt is such a compassionate person who loves beasts. He loves creatures. He loves the things that no one else will love. And Leta is that in a lot of ways. So I think he sees this kind of beast, or as Leta would say, a monster in her, and loves that about her. Doesn't want to change a thing about her. You know, I think he just sees her for what she is, and I think she needs that in her life, and I think he's the only person in her life who really sees her.
As you've heard in this chapter, Hogwarts is a place where young witches and wizards would come together to hone their talents. The same could be said for the cast and crew of this film. But for now, we're leaving our school days behind. The time has come to face the wider wizarding world, beyond the gates of Hogwarts. Next chapter, we'll hear about the threat that is looming over everyone and everything. And that threat is Gellert Grindelwald. Chapter 9, The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Ooh, if I could play any other character in Fantastic Beasts, I would play Grindelwald. Because there's something really delicious about playing such a villain. He is such a villain, and he so enjoys it. And there's something very fun about being bad and really having a good time with it.
Grindelwald is so different from a character like Voldemort, for instance, because he's not all terrifying. You know, he's actually very convincing. He's someone that believes in the greater good, and he's talking to wizards and convincing them. He's luring them, and it works.
Grindelwald is following the classic maneuver manual of people who manipulate populations of humans and just deceive one another. This, you know, easy two-part strategy of give someone an identity and then give them an enemy.
Voldemort would go around killing people willy-nilly and threatening people and bludgeoning people with his philosophy. So you kind of knew who the bad guy was. It was so obvious. Grindelwald's much more sophisticated than that, which makes him a much more credible threat to all the values that are so important to people who believe in love and light and understanding and curiosity. Because Grindelwald makes a case that's compelling for the path he wants to take us all down. And he pretends he's one of us, which makes Grindelwald probably the most dangerous villain ever.
This Gellert Grindelwald is not someone to be messed with, clearly. Then again, the clue's in the title. But who is Gellert Grindelwald, and what exactly are his crimes? Well, folks, let me break it down for you. Gellert Grindelwald is a wanted wizard and a cold-blooded killer. Grindelwald believes wizards and witches should not be in hiding and wants them to rise up and claim their rightful dominion over all non-magical people, telling them it's their birthright to rule, even if it means annihilating all non-wizards. And Grindelwald's message seems to be getting through, in part thanks to his powers of persuasion and seduction, and with catchphrases like, "Magic blooms only in rare souls." It's no wonder he's so seductive. Something that's mirrored in the clothes that Johnny Depp, who plays him, wears. Although when we first meet Grindelwald, he's rotting in a Makusa jail cell and not exactly looking his best. To learn more, we must enter the costume department to hear from textile artist Steve Gall.
So this is the fabric for Johnny's prison coat here. The original reference, I think, was a... Now, I think, anyway, was a Japanese fireman's outfit. So what's happened is, we looked at a few different fabrics that might have the right sort of feel to them. And the end result was the one that I'm holding in my hand here, which is quite a Hessian-y. I think it's a linen, it's a heavy weave linen. So that's how it started off, like in a beigey sort of brown. And then from that, we've dyed it to a nice deep sort of indigo colour. And then we went through and we did a number of different prints to see what might work with that, to try and create a bit more of a harder, dry, rougher fabric. So we've dyed it and we've printed it, and then it goes off to get made, and then we ended up breaking it down. So this is like the broken down final costume. Now, like I said, what ended up happening is we broke it down heavily first, but then when Johnny had it on in the fitting, there was the idea that came up that maybe it should be covered with cobwebs. So it came back to us, and now Olivia's starting to lay on the cobwebs on this new one here, and this is one that we did earlier. So the aim was to try and create some sort of feeling of age and, you know, being stood there, left there for a long time. So that's the sort of, like, the history and the story of what, you know, one costume might have gone through. And also Abernathy ends up wearing the same costume. So we have two different sized actors, and then their stunt doubles, which means that I think we've probably ended up making 16, I think, maybe 16 coats. There's been a few at this stage for each actor, and then there's a few without the cobwebs due to what ends up happening in the story afterwards.
Abernathy was Tina and Queenie's supervisor at MACUSA in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, but his true allegiance is revealed early on. Abernathy is again played by Kevin Guthrie.
So Abernathy starts off in movie one where he's a bit more of a job's worth, a bit straight-laced, very down the line. The journey into movie two is so far quite reckless, severe in his change from Mr. Official to reckless abandonment and absolutely a disciple of the cause for Grindelwald and part of the Acolyte. So I'd say he's the fresh meat on tour. He's the whip, he's the whipping boy. He's more sinister in his idea of what the world's all about, I think. Abernathy absolutely believes in the cause that Grindelwald's fighting for, which is sort of purity and confidence and exposure for the magic world, that we shouldn't have to live in secrecy, that we shouldn't have to live in darkness. And I believe, and Abernathy believes, that very much to be the case. I think he's more informed with what Grindelwald's all about and his sort of, I guess, puritanical outlook on the world, be that right or wrong. And I think Abernathy is desperate to please, desperate for some sort of assessment of positivity from Grindelwald. And I'm not sure that's going to come anytime soon. So that need and endeavour is strong and profound. And I think he's prepared, progressively more prepared throughout the movie, to go to any length to achieve that. For in his eyes, that is the ultimate goal and that is the ultimate victory. And for his own individual agenda, the victory is to seal the approval of said Mr. Grindelwald.
While Grindelwald may start out in prison, it's not really a spoiler to say he doesn't stay there long. Grindelwald's escape opens the film in spectacular fashion, and once out of the woods, or rather, out of the cobwebs, Colleen Atwood has him decked out in quite the showstopper.
Well, Johnny and I talked about it, and, you know, the Grindelwald name begged for a bit of an alpine twist. And I've always loved Bavarian clothing and the details on it, in the leather and the punched leather and the detail embroidery. And I've always thought Lederhosen was incredibly sexy. And Johnny went for it. I said, I just have this idea, I want to run by you. And he went for it. We embraced it. And, you know, we made the Lederhosen a little bit longer. We coupled it with a tall boot. We had a couple Marilyn Manson conversations. You know, we had, like, we went around the world. We went to a lot of places, as you do with somebody like Johnny. But we kept circling back and ended up with a slightly kind of Bavaria meets, I don't know, the new romantics. So that was sort of the journey that we made together for inventing our look for, as we call him, Grindy. So, you know, we've had a good run with this one, and, you know, no one is a more graceful kind of actor in a costume than Johnny. His movement and his, you know, when he knows it's right, his movement in the costume sells a costume in a really great way for a designer.
Yeah, you can call him Grindy if you want. I'm not going to risk it. Mr. Grindelwald for me, sir. Grindelwald's wardrobe is rounded off by a tiny piece of jewelry worn around his neck on a silver chain. A small glass orb, decorated with the Deathly Hallows. It contains a mysterious glowing substance and was designed by concept artist Molly Soule.
I think probably the most exciting thing for me on this job was doing Grindelwald's vial, mainly because in the script when I read it, it had such an important part. And there's also the history of the character. He's amazing. He's so pinnacle, not only in this, but he's also like laying the foundations for the story that comes later. And I just thought, wow, this is a really important hand prop that has a lot of meaning for him and a lot of meaning for the other people in the story as well. And it's also part of the plot. So it had to be something that reflected his kind of interest and his vision of the world, because he's always trying to get across his message to everybody about how he sees things. And I thought this object needed to connect to those kind of priorities that he has. And we already had a symbol that was really strong for that, which is the Deathly Hallows, which was established, and it's a very strong graphic logo that people know world over. And I wanted to do something that was connected to that, but also something that maybe was a precursor. So I was like looking at the symbolic shapes involved in that logo and thinking, right, if he was establishing this design because he's obsessed with these three things, how would he manifest those interests into an object that's so personal to him? So if I just took the shapes of the wand and the philosopher's stone and the cloak and just started working with those, what kind of shapes can I make? And I had this idea of the wand being like a pipette or like a sword that slots into the actual chamber itself. So I had a lot of fun doing that.
Exactly what Grindelwald's vial contains is not for me to reveal. Certainly not if I want Jacob to have a part in Fantastic Beasts 3. But I will say it does feature in the film's opening sequence, an awesome jailbreak involving flying carriages, and thestrals, and the ocean, and broomsticks. The majority of those magical elements are added after filming, and there's more than a little imagination required to bring them to life on set. It's lucky we have puppeteer Robin Guyver to provide us actors with an eye line to make sure we're all looking at the same thing.
So in our kit bag is a lot of fishing supplies, from long rods, carbon fiber poles, because at any time dealing with a creature or a magical effect that might be kind of 12 metres, 15 metres up in the air, an obscurus flying over a crowd of people, to have all those people looking at the same spot so they're all seeing the same thing, quite often we'll be putting a large light or tennis ball or a big red cross on the end of a 9-metre pole so that we can hold it up, shoot it through the air, and all those people can see that, and we can see all of their eyes following the same thing. And the camera won't see our pole, the camera won't be looking at what we're doing, we'll be doing it away from the camera, but what the camera sees is their reactions. And when those performers are looking all at the same thing, they're all imagining the same thing together as well. Again, it really helps us as viewers to be imagining it and seeing it as well, and believing that they're seeing something that isn't really there. Other parts of our fishing kit includes fishing wire. We've got those different fishing wires. Some are strong, some are very small for pulling things, knocking things over. Tomorrow we're shooting a hat that is blown by the wind. So we've attached a couple of fishing wires to a hat and we're bouncing that along as the camera follows that and then moves off it to look off down a street. We've all got fishing stools because we spend a lot of time waiting on set as well. Always ready.
Fishing wire? Wow. You're getting all the trade secrets. Who knew, huh? Besides the vial, Grindelwald is also in possession of a rather powerful wand. A wand that fans of the Wizarding World will know all too well. The Elder Wand.
The Elder Wand is infamous. As one of the three Deathly Hallows, it is not only the most legendary wand in the Wizarding World, it is probably the most powerful wand in the world. I say probably because there's a question about that, since the wand transfers its allegiance. And being in possession of the Elder Wand is not sufficient to own it. It has to give you its allegiance. It must be won. Over the years, that has meant a series of exceptionally powerful wizards have won it from each other. But Grindelwald actually stole it from a wand maker named Gregorovich. And, as Harry Potter fans will know, it remains in his possession until 1945. Which makes him really, really formidable.
Formidable, charming, and smartly dressed. It's a dangerous combo. I mean, I should know. And like any charismatic leader, Grindelwald has a group of loyal followers hanging off his every word. Just as Voldemort has his Death Eaters, Grindelwald has his own group of acolytes. And Poppy Corby-Tuish, Andrew Turner, and Claudius Peters play three of them.
I am playing Wolsey, and I'm Grindelwald's wingwoman.
I play Macduff, and I play one of the acolytes.
I play Noggle, and I'm one of the acolytes. Some people will say they're revolutionaries. I would say we're revolutionaries. Do you agree?
Yeah.
The revolutionaries, they want to make the world a better place from their point of view anyway. And they're part of Grindelwald's team in order to do that.
Yeah, you could say like they're followers, but with a purpose. So anything that he does, the majority of us, I think, are on board. I think people are a little bit...
Or are they?
Wary.
Not everyone's on board.
Well, I suppose
not everyone's on board.
Yeah, a lot of us are on board.
I'm on board.
Whether they're fully on board or not, each one sure looks the part. Courtesy of Colleen Atwood, of course.
The Acolytes are a quirky group. I mean, they're very different types. So with each of them, I gave them a personality. They were heavies, but in different styles. There's the street heavy with his fur collar that's more like, you know, from the north of Paris. And then there's the tall, kind of elegant enforcer. And Nagal, the beautiful young African man, whose face tells a thousand stories. He has the most beautiful face. And I felt like he had a really heavy presence without doing anything. So I sort of kept him very, you know, not heavily clothed and sort of elegant in his own way.
A suave set of heavies. I wouldn't expect anything less for the followers of Grindelwald. Kevin Guthrie.
Johnny is as rock and roll as it could possibly be to be rock and roll. You're watching a master of his art in front of you, and I guess just being a part of that is huge, but very much Kevin's affection for Johnny would mirror Abernathy's affection for Grindelwald, which assumes the role far easier, and I guess there's a little bit less acting required in that moment.
Yeah, he toys that line of being charming and terrifying really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, it's very charismatic. You can understand why so many people follow Grindelwald, because he's very persuasive.
Yeah.
Very charming with it.
Yeah. I love him. A little bit. Probably a little bit too much.
Yeah.
Throughout the movie, we see how Grindelwald's message impacts the wizarding community. He stages a mass rally where witches and wizards gather together in a Roman-style amphitheater to hear him speak. The amphitheater is an enormous and elaborate Stuart Craig creation. Though it looks real, the whole thing is an illusion. Everything is made of wood, plaster, sand, foam, fiberglass, plywood, polystyrene, that's styrofoam to Americans, underpinned by a jungle of scaffolding. To create something of this size and scale takes multiple departments all pulling together. Paul Taggart is head of the film's plastering department. Thanks, guys. Thanks for stopping right at the end there.
Everything you see on the construction set is more or less covered in plaster, foam, fiberglass, and that's what we achieve. We can take impressions off of an original stone, or we can do them freehand from reference. We have a team of sculptors as well that can reproduce certain stonework and mouldings to a different age, and then we'll do like a silicone rubber mould of those and then mass produce in plaster or fiberglass or foam, depending on, you know, how many need to be made for the set. The plastering department and the sculpting department have always worked closely together, always in tandem, because they make something and then we'll take a mould off of that.
The majority of the sculptures are actually carved out of polystyrene, including the stone raven resting above the Lestrange family mausoleum. David Hodges is the head of the department. His team of sculptors chip away in a workshop that looks like a massive beanbag chair has exploded. There are pieces of polystyrene everywhere, covering everything and everybody. It's astonishing just how much of this movie is made with it.
Put it all on the set, fill it, paint it, and it's there. And then it can easily be taken out again. Because sometimes they might not want it in, they might want to change it, you can change it, you can cut pieces out. So it's good like that. So yeah, a lot of the sets are polystyrene. What's in them could have been cast from a polystyrene.
It really does take an army to bring these sets to life. And once the polystyrene has been carved, plasterers and painters come in. In the case of building the amphitheater, their job is to make the newly minted white, plasticky bricks, columns, and sculptures look like hard, ancient grey stone.
I'm Patrick Norcott. I'm an improver, plasterer. I love my team. They're quality. It's like being back at school. You can have banter here. Love it. It's not like you want to go home. Well, I do want to go home, you know what I mean? But I enjoy being here at the same time, you know what I mean? I'm always learning something different. It's just quality. I've made this alleyway. I put all these brick sheets up for this alleyway. Made some of them columns out there.
The alleyway leads into the amphitheater, and it is textured to look like real stone.
We use a lot of sand, small tools, bit of colour in our plaster, hit it with a brush. It's pretty simple, really. What is it like? It's like a cathedral, isn't it? Like, we use it as the Nou Camp, Barcelona Stadium. Yeah, it's so high and steep, you know what I mean? I'd have this in my back garden or something like that, you know what I mean? It mind blows me. Because I've only been here 4 years, and I can walk in a set now and I can be like, what? Like, it's just mad. I've done most of them stairs, so when that film comes out, I can say to my girlfriend, I've done most of them stairs there. All them alleyways I've done. I've done a lot in this film that's going to be quite a main shot. So, yeah, I'm quite proud of all this.
Head of plastering, Paul Taggart.
Well, that started off just as a step section in ply and scaffolding. And then we've kind of dressed on top of that with sheets of polystyrene, and we've put plaster over the top of that, a mixture of hard plaster and sawdust, which is a special plaster that just it sets like concrete. With the sawdust, it was just an old traditional method. It sets kind of like in 20 minutes. So rather than using sand and cement, we use that method so as people could walk on it straight away, whereas the other methods, we'd have to wait till the next day. And it's kind of been a banked up step section, and there's walkways off of it, and right around the very top, you'll see in the film all the architecture, all the figures, you know, dating back to the, I'm assuming it's the Greek and Roman times, I think. But it's just, for a simple set, it's just, again, it's breathtaking. It really is. And we've got a lot of fancy mouldings on there, which is, again, from the art department, starting from scratch. We've built them up with us and the sculpting department, taken moulds, mass-produced, and you'll see when the film comes out that they're all these statues and mini tombs that are dotted around the place. The detail in those is just something else as well. You know, it just looks... I know that's what the films are about, to make it look real, but these slight little details that Stuart puts into his drawings, just, you know, you think you're back in ancient times. You really do.
I can't even put into words how impressive this set is. Large enough to house all of our cast, as well as the 500 extras needed for Grindelwald's rally. The extras arrive at Leavesden each day, typically before dawn, and are herded into hair and makeup before visiting Colleen Atwood's costume department, where they're transformed into witches and wizards by Colleen and her army of dressers.
Well, I think what I was looking for is a face. As a face came in, I would see something in the face that I felt could become either a businessman that's gone astray, a disheartened worker, which was heavily part of that period. It was a time of huge turmoil in labor. So I had a lot of people that I felt were laborers, but that sort of were shifting over to sort of a more kind of fascist point of view. I mean, at one point, David said, think of it as a rock concert. So there's the people that are the groupies that like kind of like take a nod from Grindelwald and their acolytes in their styling of it, like when you go to a concert and there's people that kind of dress like aspects of the band, but then there's people that are just there and in that moment see something they've never seen before and connect with it, which is part of the human experience. So it's a really interesting combination, and, you know, the auras come into it, and there were people I dressed as auras, which I had the French auras and the British auras there. So they had their own looks. The British auras more tweedy, less of a uniform look, and the French more like a nod to the resistance, kind of the leather jacket with a beret, which is a bit more militaristic. But the combination of all those together in a room helped sell the fact that something was going on. And I took period pieces and added a few aspects of my own kind of design to them to change them into kind of a quasi look with like a triple strand belt and all kinds of things like that to sort of tweak it in a direction that it could be, you knew it was something away from the norm.
Once the extras have been dressed, they're lined up so that Colleen can inspect them and make any alterations before the scene begins. Being an extra involves a lot of hanging around, and since the movie's storyline is top secret, those involved in the amphitheater scenes are told virtually nothing about what's being filmed. That doesn't stop people guessing, and some take their new wizarding personas very seriously indeed.
I'm Artem, I'm 34, and today I'm playing a wizard. I'm mentally unhappy about something, but hopefully things are going to work out.
My name's Harriet, and I'm playing an amphitheatre audience member for a scene full of baddies and people that might be baddies. I think a mixture of people. I think I'm probably just half curious about what's going on.
Today I've been upgraded to a wizard. We are doing a scene in an amphitheatre, and it's a secret wizard witches gathering scene.
Hello, I'm Janine, and I'm literally one of the good people against the bad side.
Hi, I'm Sabu. I'm here as an extra. I've got this absolutely amazing cape. I absolutely love it. I love the structure, the tailoring. It's very tailored, very bold. I love black. Black is always a good color. I love the hair. The hair is amazing. But I think that was really, really outstanding. So I think we're all very chic and sleek, and then these good people are all natural.
Excuse me. My costumes are more about earthy witchery kind. I've got like greens, neutral colours, where black is horrible. And I'm just more of a friendly wizard.
We basically have a character because we are part of the bad guys. So exactly, we're not 100% who we're worshipping at this point. But as a bad guy, I know that, you know, we have to embody. We're embodying the look of the bad guy. And I think she's doing a good job of a good girl.
So I'm embodying the look of the good witchery, but I'm kind of being convinced to go to the bad side, trying to show me what muggles are against us.
I say, come to the dark side.
Good or bad, everyone's here to see Grindelwald, whose speech will have a lasting impact on everyone who hears it, as well as the wizarding world as a whole. One of those caught in the middle of it all is Tina, played by Catherine Waterston.
I really love what Joe's exploring here. The danger, the extreme danger of a person who has figured out how to use fear to control a lot of people. We see this in our world all the time. You know, there's a lot of terrifying things about life, and we all deal with it and try to keep our chins up and carry on. And when someone gets really good at manipulating those fears, well, we've seen what can happen. Horrifying wars, the kind of damage that can never be fixed. So it's heavy stuff, and it's really terrifying. And I found, even in this heightened reality with all these wonderful elements and adorable creatures and so much fun and shenanigans going on, those moments, like this big scene at the end where Grindelwald is manipulating and seducing a big room full of people who are almost all of them hooked, was chilling to witness.
Another is Alison Sudol's Queenie.
I think that people will feel their heart race when they watch it. And I think that they are going to be, like we all are, sort of concerned and you know, wanting to find out where they go, where they each go, how they navigate these situations. You know, it tugs at your heart. David always talks about keeping the human element at the forefront, and you're watching these characters as they grow. This is a very important part of their evolution, and it's a very important time in history, and it's very pertinent for now.
For some, however, there are no easy answers. Take Ezra Miller's Credence.
The tragic irony to the journey is that, you know, Grindelwald, who is, of course, casting his malicious web, you know, his insidious nexus to draw everyone in to his plot. And the tragedy is that Grindelwald holds the knowledge of Credence's true identity. And that just as Credence, who has truly had nothing to live for except to know who he is, just as he reaches that place of identification that he's so desired, it's another chapter that really speaks to this very archetypal journey that Credence is on. You know, we had this person who was victim to violence and abuse, who was victim to repression from external sources and then how that was internalized. And, you know, now we have that person seeking, having removed those layers, trying to actually understand what's underneath and trying to find a way to be solid in his own reality and struggling to do so, as many of us do, and ultimately then being so easily manipulated by someone who, essentially with this one piece of real information, is also enforcing the illusion that, you know, you can fully know yourself. And more than that, you can know yourself as separate from the other guy who then becomes your enemy. And that's, Grindelwald is following the classic maneuver manual of people who manipulate populations of humans and just deceive one another. This, you know, easy two-part strategy of give someone an identity and then give them an enemy.
Grindelwald certainly isn't one to mess with. Luckily, we made it out of there. And I'm not one to leave things on a bad note. Speaking of which, there's one more guy I want to introduce you to before we leave. But, we need to make a little detour. Come with me. We're here at the world-famous Abbey Road Studios.
Oh, my God.
In London, to meet composer James Newton Howard, who has spent several months working out the musical score with director David Yates. He's now here with 98 members of a specially selected orchestra who are tuning up, ready to record the music for Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Because once we get this, it's just the same. I want to do exactly the same each measure. Yeah.
54. 1, 2, ready, and...
Abbey Road was made famous by a little band called the Beatles, and probably the most iconic shot of a zebra crossing slash crosswalk ever. It's also where a host of artists have recorded some of the greatest records of all time across all genres of music. Basically, to walk through these doors, you have to be a rock star. And this isn't James Newton Howard's first trip to the famed studio, nor is it his first venture into the wizarding world. He composed the original score for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So let's join him on a quick break from recording to hear how it's going so far.
You know, it's incredibly gratifying when you get to this stage. I've been working on the movie since end of January. So it's been a long, long process. But, you know, there's no better musical opportunity in the world than Fantastic Beasts. So, yeah, it's been great. And David's a great collaborator, and we're having a good time. Okay, hold on one second. Mary, can you go get a little bit louder to your B? One of my favorite times is when I'm by myself in my studio, and I'm just sort of figuring out the puzzle of the movie. And you have these moments of absolute terror, and they can be lengthy, where you're just not coming up with good material and the clock is ticking and I'm supposed to go to London in mid-June and it's now March and I'm still got a lot of unfinished business. But eventually I do kind of work out the puzzle. It's like a three-dimensional chess game, really. And then what I try and do is make demos, electronic demos of the entire score before I come over here. And then David and I go through, and at that point, David really begins to focus seriously on the music. And we just make our way through every piece of music in the movie and decide, well, this is right, this is right, this isn't right. And of course, I thought the movie was delightful. I really enjoyed the movie. It had, you know, it was just kind of irresistible in a lot of ways. And I think there was a lot of kind of exposition and introducing of characters, which was kind of fun to meet these new people. But now I think in the second one, things take a slightly more, I don't know, substantial and complex and in some cases darker turn. So, it's just been, the whole thing has just been a great arc to be a part of. It's got a lot of music. I think we've got 2 hours and 10 minutes of music or 2 hours and 5 minutes of music, which is exciting and challenging at the same time. But there's a lot of action and a lot of thriller stuff. And yeah, I would say it's very, you're kind of on the edge of your seat at various times, but it's also can be funny and romantic in a few places too.
Once those electronic demos are approved by our director, David Yates, the orchestra is hand-picked and brought here to Abbey Road Studios to begin their 2-week recording of the film score.
Low brass, join when you join. Horns, do what you do on this part, okay?
I'm parked here at Abbey Road for about 3 months and just trying to keep up with the picture changes, and I think we pretty much have. And then it's all of my electronic demos are eventually turned into music score. And then we bring in all these incredible musicians, and they play it, and then we go from there.
The film itself is played on screens so that the director and composer can see exactly how the music works with the moving picture. In this instance, it really is the musicians that make the magic happen.
I think that this group of players in this room is the most optimal environment in the world for this movie. So I can't give a higher compliment than that. I'm just honored and thrilled every time I have the privilege of working with them. You know, they've forgotten more than I know about music, and they play with the greatest artists in the world. And I feel very close to this orchestra, and we've collaborated together in many cases for more than 20 years. And so I just have a great team. They've just really elevated my work to a much higher level than it would be otherwise. So I'm always grateful to my team.
So start us at 53, Chris, at 8-3. Low brass, join when you join. Horns, do what you do.
There is kind of an aura, a gravitas aura, when you walk into the building, because other than the Beatles, lots of incredible people have worked here. Just about anybody has worked here and been thrilled to work here, and from classical to every other genre of music. So, you know, you almost feel it incumbent upon you to do somehow an extra special job when you're here, and I have to pinch myself. Oh, I'm in Abbey Road with 98 of the world's greatest musicians and working on an incredible movie. So it's just inspiring, I guess, is what it is. But you know, when you hear the sound coming back, and with Sean's work, who's extraordinary, it's just thrilling. It's really a thrilling experience. I never get tired of it.
So what can we expect this time around from the music maestro,
See, we had a bunch of theme introductions in the first one. We had what I consider to be really the main theme of the movie, which is played throughout, and I won't attempt to sing it, but you'll have to sort of divine. You know, it's interesting, it has a fanfare over the main title, which is something, it's an unusual structure, because the fanfare music over the main title is not really employed much in the rest of the movie. So you have this almost standalone, big triumphant kind of announcement, which seems to just somehow work. Then, of course, we had a kind of romantic theme that we used a little bit with Tina and Newt and in a couple of other places. That was also, when Newt releases the Thunderbird, that was kind of a big emotional moment. We had Jacob had a theme, which was kind of ragtime piano from the period, which was fun. And then, that's probably most of then. Newt himself had a kind of a jaunty little and then we have new themes.
starting with the moodiest and darkest of them all.
Yes, thank you. Grindelwald's theme was actually introduced in near the very end of the last one. I kind of snuck in an Easter egg there. And if you go back and listen to that when he's being led away, you'll hear that does indeed become his theme throughout the movie. The fanfare comes back again. You know, we meet Leda, who is just moody and dark and gorgeous and just fantastic character, complex. And I've written, I think, some pretty music for her.